explosive growth of integrative medicine in the 21st century, in which the philosophical contradictions between the different treatment modalities could be dismissed with a wave of a hand and a mumbled reference to quantum physics. Holistic biology. By the late 20th century, there is no question that medical science needed some sort of paradigm shift, if only to accommodate the fact that a whole person, body in addition to mind, is not well represented by a cadaver. Not only do we think and feel, but we react to the world in microscopic ways that are not visible to our minds and not easily accessible to our willpower or control. We bleed when cut, and if we are lucky, the blood clots without our conscious intervention. The system that is a whole person contains many levels and parts. Some are macroscopic, and some are microscopic. Some are material, such as an organ. Others apparently immaterial, as in the case of thoughts. How they interact to create a stable, or at least briefly stable, system has been the ongoing challenge to biological science. The assumption, which has been around long enough to be almost unquestioned, has been that all parts and layers of the body work in concert. When we talk about human biology, we are, of course, talking about the biology of multicellular beings composed of subunits like tissues and cells. All these tissues and cells are presumed to work in harmony, each selflessly performing its assigned function, like obedient citizens of a benign dictatorship. Heart cells beat in unison, liver cells store glucose, red blood cells carry oxygen. Anything else would be a disaster, right? Thus, the biology of multicellular beings is biased toward a holistic outlook. We aren't content to describe, say, a kidney. We want to know what its function is, what it does in service to the whole. The assignment of functions to different parts or subunits of the body goes back at least to the 17th century, when the English physician William Harvey figured out that the beating of the heart keeps the blood circulating, although why circulation was important was still not clear at the time. Prior to this discovery, anatomists had been content to describe and locate the organs, leaving it to physiologists or metaphysicians to explain what the organs actually did and how they fit into the body as a whole. According to Harvey, the heart had a function, and, as biologists quickly inferred, so must all other subunits and parts of the body. Pick up a contemporary biology textbook, and you will find it thickly populated by the word function, sometimes applied even to molecules. A 2014 cell biology textbook finds various ways of describing the commitment of cells and tissues to their functions. They have the responsibility or task of performing these functions, or they are said to be specialized to perform them, much like soldiers in an army or professors in a university. Harvey's discovery revealed the body to be a kind of machine, cleverly built up out of interconnecting, smoothly cooperating parts that had no volition of their own. As a 17th century Italian anatomist proclaimed, "A human body, as to its natural actions, is truly nothing else but a complex of chemico-mechanical motions, depending on such principles as are purely mathematical." This mechanical view, which still dominates biology today, in no way challenged religion. After all, an extraordinarily brilliant designer must be behind the whole thing, or must at least have breathed life into some inert prior substance. And indeed, the more we learn about how the body works, the more supernaturally marvelous its working seems. Consider how the body heals its wounds. First, a cascade of chemical reactions closes the lesion by making blood clot. At the same time, cells rush in from the bone marrow and other sites to chase out microbes, remove damaged tissue, and replace it with fresh, intact cells and tissues, so that we are prepared for any future wounds. If the body is a perfect clockwork mechanism, This was, according to a cheap and dirty form of Darwinism, because perfection was inevitable. Bodily parts that didn't work or work optimally would be eliminated by natural selection, leaving only the fittest organisms to survive and breed. In the sociobiology that thrived in the 1960s, there was an evolutionary rationale for everything, and any trait or physical characteristic that did not contribute to the survival of the species would be weeded out as a waste of energy. This led to a noxious defense of the status quo, often denounced by feminists as determinism. "We are the way we are," say warlike or male supremacist, "because to be any other way would be less fit, and the sculptor that shaped us this way is not God, but natural selection." The trouble was that many things cannot be explained in terms of fitness, including vestigial characteristics like male nipples and the appendix, as well as purely structural features that just seem to be required by the available designs in our genomes. Biologists Stephen Jay Gould and Richard Lewontin deemed that such structural features are the analog of spandrels in the design of cathedrals. They don't do anything except to fill in a pre-existing pattern of arches. Natural selection, Gould and Lewontin pointed out, is not the only force governing evolution, nor had Darwin ever suggested that it was. Changes in the environment, climate changes, or the sudden arrival of an asteroid, can cause the extinction of whole species that may have been supremely well adapted the moment before a disaster struck. Meanwhile, apparently useless features like male nipples may be conserved over generations simply because the plan for them remains in our genetic material. So the unacknowledged bias in biology is optimistic, even utopian. Our bodies are perfectly adapted to the environment, or at least to the environment our distant ancestors faced, and they are that way because they could be no other way. In their critique of evolutionary biology, Gould and Lewontin invoked Voltaire's insanely optimistic Professor Pangloss, who had declared that everything was for the best in this best of all possible worlds. The same could be said of the functional view of the body, which carries with it the assumption that all the parts and subunits act in harmony, ever alert to the needs of the whole. This is how we are introduced to biology as students, as the study of ideally functioning complex systems in which disease and death are disappointing aberrations. But all is not well in this best of all possible worlds, and the aberrations are too common, not to mention too dramatic, to dismiss. Consider cancer, which is one of the leading causes of death worldwide. Many cancers can be blamed on chemical agents or radiation from outside the body, such as cigarette smoke or occupational hazards like benzene. But so far, only about 60% of cancers can be traced to particular carcinogens. For example, no carcinogens have been discovered to explain cancers of the breast, colon, or prostate. All we know is that individual cells within these organs sometimes break ranks and start reproducing madly, creating tumors that can destroy the entire organism. Or consider autoimmune diseases, such as rheumatoid arthritis and multiple sclerosis, which afflict 5 to 8% of the population and arise when the immune system abandons its designated function, which is to protect the body, and attacks the body itself. The body's own immune cells have also been implicated in the development of coronary artery disease, the greatest single cause of mortality in the United States and Europe. The functionalist view of the body is still immensely helpful, but only if we remember that it is an approximation. Most skin cells, for example, behave as we would expect them to if their functions are to serve as a protection against the outside world, to perspire, and to provide us with tactile experience. But some will become cancerous and attempt to take over the entire body. And what is the function of melanoma? we need to admit that instead of acting as a harmonious whole, the body can serve as a battleground where its own cells and tissues meet in mortal combat. The potential theoretical basis for intrabody conflict had been laid out by Rudolf Virchow in the late 19th century, when he proposed that the smallest living subunit of the body was the cell, and that all cells arose from other cells. It was the latter proposition, expressed as omnis cellula e cellula, that tended to attract the most attention because it implied that even the most ferocious cancer cell was the descendant of a peaceable, law-abiding, healthy cell. But in some ways, it was the first proposition, that the cell was the smallest living subunit of the body, that perhaps should have generated more excitement. At the time of Virchow's work, other biologists were beginning to succeed in cultivating body cells outside of the body, in what came to be called tissue cultures, bathed in a nutrient fluid such as a serum. The stage was set by the beginning of the 20th century for a thorough study of these curious microscopic entities, cells, that make up living organisms. But this was the road not taken. The middle of the 20th century brought the stunning discovery of the structure of DNA and its role in heredity. Almost overnight, biology entered its extreme reductionist phase, zipping right past cells to get to the more glamorous molecular level, where DNA, RNA, and proteins ruled. Cancer research came to focus on the DNA mutations that predispose cells to a career of selfish reproduction. Immunology downplayed the cellular dynamics of the immune system in favor of an obsession with antibodies. The protein molecules that can mark a foreign cell, like a microbe, for destruction. Although it is chiefly specialized immune cells called macrophages that do the destroying. My first thesis advisor at Rockefeller University won a Nobel Prize for elucidating the structure of antibody molecules. My second thesis advisor got far less recognition and a much smaller lab for his work on how macrophages kill and digest their prey. Cancer is hard enough to explain. Why would a cell undertake a campaign of conquest that can only end in that cell's own death? But cancer is commonly traced to errors in cell division, and it is easy to imagine such errors leading a healthy cell to produce two cancerous daughter cells. Autoimmune diseases, like rheumatoid arthritis and multiple sclerosis, in which the immune system attacks healthy tissue within the body, pose a more vexing philosophical problem for biology. It is possible to imagine a single cell producing cancerous offspring, but it is not so easy to see how the many delicate mechanisms making up the immune response, which involve interactions between multiple types of cells, could be mobilized against the body's own tissues. Posed with the possibility of such an attack, biologist Paul Ehrlich simply postulated the existence of a built-in horror autotoxicus, or horror of self-poisoning, that would somehow prevent such hideous mistakes. How could there not be such a thing, since life cannot harm itself, as the dogma of horror autotoxicus put it? For an organism to undermine itself would be, in Ehrlich's words, dysteleological in the highest degree, meaning that it would serve no purpose. 50 years later, in the middle of the 20th century, the Australian immunologist Frank McFarlane Burnett took Ehrlich's dictum about the impossibility of autoimmune disorders a little further when he proclaimed that the true function of the immune system was a metaphysical one, to distinguish self and non-self, the latter being foreign material such as microbes, and the former being one's own tissues. These are terms drawn from psychology or philosophy. They are nebulous, as philosopher of science Alfred I. Tauber has pointed out, adding that the self can hardly be viewed as a scientific concept. In fact, it was barely even a concept at all until about the 17th century, When languages such as English and German began to use the word self as something other than an intensifier, as in, I did it myself. Then, as we shall see in a later chapter, the self began to replace the soul as a special kind of kernel within each individual, walled off in part from everyone else. Attention turned inward, as people were encouraged to know themselves through, for example, the widespread use of mirrors, the writing of journals and autobiographies, and the painting of portraits, often self-portraits. Western individualism was born, along eventually with psychoanalysis and any number of afflictions of the self. So why did Burnett choose such a nebulous and patently unscientific concept to explain the work of the immune system? Some scholars have speculated that he was influenced, like so many people of his class, by Freud, and perhaps actually attracted by the aura of subjectivity that hovers around the notion of the self. He could, after all, have used some other term like the organism or the individual to describe what the immune system is trying to maintain. But if he was looking for a way to talk about the organism versus the others, generally meaning foreign invaders like microbes, the self-non-self distinction was apt enough. At the heart of immunology is a military metaphor. Non-self is the enemy, usually represented by a bacterium or a virus, and has to be destroyed by the immune system, while self, meaning the body's own tissues, of course has to be left alone. For example, a popular 1987 book, optimistically entitled The Body Victorious, described the immune system as reminiscent of military defense with regard to both weapon technology and strategy. Our internal army has at its disposal swift, highly mobile regiments, shock troops, snipers, and tanks. We have soldier cells which, on contact with the enemy, at once start producing homing missiles whose accuracy is overwhelming, as well as reconnaissance squads, an intelligence service, and a defense staff which determines the location and strength of troops to be deployed. The military metaphor can even be tapped to help explain, or excuse, autoimmune diseases. Any human society within a spear's throw of potential enemies needs some kind of defensive force. Minimally, an armed group who can defend against invaders. But there are risks to maintaining a garrison, or beyond that, a standing army. The warriors may get greedy and turn against their own people, demanding ever more food and other resources. Similarly, in the case of the body, without immune cells, we would be helpless in the face of invading microbes. With them, we face the possibility of treasonous attacks on ourselves, the autoimmune diseases that Burnett at one point likened to a mutiny in the security forces of a country. In fact, no compelling evolutionary explanation for the existence of autoimmune disease has been offered, just the excuse that the immune cells, despite their supposed function of distinguishing self from non-self, sometimes make a mistake. And why should that be? One popular hypothesis, proposed in 1989, is that the relatively hygienic environments of affluent societies do not give immune cells enough practice in facing their real enemies from the microbial world. They grow up, in other words, soft and pampered. But today there is increasing acknowledgement that the link between lack of childhood exposure is not one of cause and effect. One possibility is that highly hygienic environments may simply allow more children to live long enough to develop an autoimmune disease. As Burnett commented, one cannot discuss autoimmune disease without getting into deep water philosophically. We could say, in retrospect, that Burnett was torn between two paradigms. One, the holistic utopian one, saw the body or organism as a well-ordered mechanism, evolutionarily ordained to be exactly as it is. In the other emerging paradigm, which could be called dystopian, the organism is a site of constant conflict, as between cancer cells and normal cells, or between the immune system and the other tissues in the body. The conflict may result in some sort of compromise in which, for example, the disease settles into a chronic condition. Or it may end, sooner rather than later, in the death of the organism. These two paradigms, utopian and dystopian, may coexist in the same individual mind, Burnett's, for example, but to my knowledge they have yet to square off in open combat. There, however, was a near collision in the early 1990s, for anyone who was paying attention, and it was not about autoimmune disease or cancer, but about something more normal and apparently healthy. Menstruation. Blood feuds. The onset of menstruation can be appalling, even terrifying, to the young girl who experiences it. There may be painful cramps, leaky tampons or pads, bouts of anemia. Yet at least among the affluent and educated, every effort is made to normalize this oddly violent occurrence, even to prettify it. A parenting website advises, "It's also important for parents to paint the process of menstruation in a positive light. If a mother refers to her period as the curse, her daughter might get a negative impression of the whole experience. Instead, mothers can explain that monthly periods are a natural and wonderful part of being a woman. After all, without them, women couldn't become mothers." Undeterred by the question of why a 12-year-old girl should find it wonderful that she is now capable of becoming pregnant, the positive pro-menstrual propaganda goes on in its upbeat way. A writer for the American Psychological Association offers another way to keep it positive. Some parents have successfully put together a welcome to womanhood basket that might include chocolate, a heating pad, hygiene supplies, and perhaps a good book on the topic, or a novel from her favorite author, if she doesn't already have one. Somehow, the gift of a heating pad and hygiene supplies may seem more ominous than welcoming. In the positive view, menstruation has a serious biological function. Every month, at least in humans, the lining of the uterus grows thick, supposedly to provide a soft cushion for any fertilized eggs that find their way into it. If no embryo implants, the uterus sheds this lining, if only because it would be costly in a caloric sense to maintain it, hence the mess of blood and tissue fragments that make up the menstrual discharge. But repeated monthly, over decades, the shedding of the uterine lining is itself very costly. Women typically lose a pint of blood a year and sometimes several more, creating the risk of anemia. So if natural selection prevails, and if it works to optimize a species' fitness, why do we menstruate so copiously? In particular, why do humans lose so much more blood than any other creature? The answer, or at least an answer, came from an unlikely source. In 1993, Margie Profit, a 35-year-old with no academic background in biology, proposed that the real function of menstruation is to cleanse the vagina of pathogens that may have been introduced by an intruding penis. I welcomed her hypothesis, which seemingly made the case that menstruation is not a result of female uncleanness, as patriarchal religions had insisted. Catholic churches, for example, had barred menstruating women. Jewish law required women to undergo a ritual bath after their periods. But according to Profit's theory, menstruation, for all its messiness, was actually an effort to maintain the naturally pristine condition of the female body, a sort of douche in reverse. Within a couple of years, Profit had won a MacArthur Genius Award and been profiled in Scientific American, Omni, Time, and People. She became the exemplar of the kind of optimistic biology in which everything happens for a reason, that reason being to preserve the individual organism and propagate the species. There was still conflict in her model, but only the ancient conflict between humans or other mammals and their traditional enemy, microbes. I tracked her down in the late 1990s to ask a question based on my years of study into the effect of animal predators on human evolution and history, plus my own experience of warnings you are likely to encounter in bear-ridden wild areas. Might not copious menstruation have been a risk factor for predator attacks, especially in the carnivore-ridden evolutionary environment? Her terse answer, that humans are not a cryptic species, was biologically uninformed, since a cryptic species is not one that has to hide from predators, but one that is morphologically identical to a species with a different genome. But mine was only one of a growing number of questions about her theory. Other critics brought up the lack of data on the cleansing effect of the menstrual flow, and her failure to explain the fact that human menstruation is so much more copious than that of any other mammal. In fact, very few mammals menstruate at all, and the few that do, other higher primates, some bats, and the elephant shrew, lose far less blood than humans, although there is no evidence that the semen of their males is any less germ-ridden than that of human males. Prophet's other much-heralded theoretical proposal, that the morning sickness characteristic of human pregnancy served to protect the fetus from exposure to foods that might cause birth defects, was similarly assailed, and in about 2004, Margie Prophet simply disappeared, only to resurface in 2012 and rejoin her family of origin after a period of poverty and illness. Today, the emerging scientific consensus about menstruation hinges on conflict within our species, a possibility that would until recently have been deeply disturbing to biologists. In this view, the buildup of the uterine lining does not serve to entice embryos to implant, but to prevent all but the most robust and agile embryos from ever having a chance. I will not attempt to trace the lineage of this counterintuitive idea, except to say that another renegade scientist, Robert Trivers of Rutgers, had argued in the 1970s that the father and mother have different genetic interests at stake. Put crudely, the father wants, or more accurately, his genes should want, the embryos he has fertilized to implant and live. The mother's interest is in destroying any potentially defective embryos that might waste her energy on a fruitless pregnancy. Trivers, who is no less a fascinating character than Prophet, deserves a book of his own, and in fact has written one, Wildlife, that has less to say about science than about his adventurous career, including his membership in the Black Panther Party and long residency in Jamaica. Maybe these experiences gave him the moxie to challenge the more harmonious and utopian tendencies in biology. Not only did he find deadly competition between the sexes even in their most intimate moments, but he proposed that our genomes contain many stretches of DNA, often subsumed under the label junk DNA, that are truly selfish in the sense that they have discovered ways to spread and persist without contributing to organismal fitness. At times, this means encoding actions that are diametrically opposed to those of the majority of genes. As a consequence, most organisms are not completely harmonious wholes, and the individual is, in fact, divisible. Trivers's work seems to have emboldened his friend, Harvard biologist David Haig, to offer a far more dystopian view of reproduction than anything Prophet and her admirers could have imagined. In 1993, the same year that Prophet published her work on menstruation, Haig put forth the surprising view that pregnancy was shaped by maternal-fetal competition. The fetus and the placenta that attaches it to the maternal bloodstream strive to extract more nutrients from the mother, while maternal tissue fights to hold on to its nutrients, often to the detriment of the mother. For example, the fetus may interfere with maternal insulin production, leading to elevated blood sugar levels that are injurious to the mother but deliciously nourishing to the fetus. Or the fetus and placenta may release chemicals that raise the mother's blood pressure, apparently to guarantee a ready flow of nutrients to the fetus, although at some risk to the mother and ultimately to the fetus as well. But the maternal-fetal battle begins before implantation, when the embryo and its placenta have to fight their way through endometrial lining to get access to the maternal bloodstream. As evolutionary biologist Suzanne Sadadin, who once studied with Haig, wrote, "Far from offering a nurturing embrace, the endometrium is a lethal testing ground which only the toughest embryos survive. The longer the female can delay that placenta reaching her bloodstream, the longer she has to decide if she wants to dispose of this embryo without significant cost. The embryo, in contrast, wants to implant its placenta as quickly as possible, both to obtain access to its mother's rich blood and to increase her stake in its survival. For this reason, the endometrium got thicker and tougher, and the fetal placenta got correspondingly more aggressive. In other words, a kind of arms race has gone on between the human endometrium and the human embryo-placental combination. Human placentas are extraordinarily tough fighters compared to those of other species, and our endometria are correspondingly thick and forbidding. Hence the uniquely heavy flow that human females experience, the cramps, blood-stained panties, and perhaps also the widespread cultural notion that women are peculiarly disabled versions of men. Many phases of women's reproductive cycle, from menstruation to labor, resemble the kind of inflammatory response the human body usually mounts when invaded by pathogens, except that in the reproductive case, the targets are not pathogens but human cells and tissues. Menstruation, for example, is not the gentle autumnal-sounding process of shedding an endometrial lining that it is usually described as. When no embryo implants, the uterus releases chemical signals summoning immune cells to come in from the bloodstream and devour its thick endometrial lining, which quickly becomes a killing field, with the debris pouring out of the vagina. Fortunately, during most of human existence, thanks to frequent pregnancies and lengthy periods of lactation, human females probably endured very few menstrual periods during their lifetimes. So far, no adequate explanation has been found for the fact that among humans, about 80% of those who suffer from autoimmune diseases are female, suggesting that as holistic systems, men are much better designed than women. Or it may be that we should see autoimmune diseases as just another part of the greater reproductive burden borne by women. All the inflammatory storms whipped up by menstruation and pregnancy may lead to a hazardous level of immune sensitivity, or, to put it in Burnett's vague philosophical terms, maybe pregnancy and the preparations for it inherently blurred the distinction between self and non-self. But the point is that intra-body conflict between cells and their own sibling cells within the same organism is not confined to pathological conditions like cancer and autoimmune diseases, where it can be traced to a mutation or described as a mistake. Deadly combat among cells is part of how the body, and especially the human body, conducts its normal business, which certainly includes reproduction. If cells are alive and can seemingly act in their own interests against other parts of the body, or even against the entire organism, then we may need to see ourselves less as smoothly running holes that can be controlled by conscious human intervention, and more as confederations, or at least temporary alliances, of microscopic creatures. It is disconcerting to think of the biological self, or body, as a collection of tiny selves. The image that comes to mind is the grotesque portrait of a supersized king in the frontispiece of philosopher Thomas Hobbes's Leviathan. On close inspection, the king turns out to be composed of hundreds of little people crowded into his arms and torso. Hobbes's point was that human societies need autocratic leaders. Otherwise, they risk degenerating into a war of all against all. But no king rules the community of cells that makes up the body. Despite, or sometimes because of, all the communications, chemical and electrical, that connect the cells of the body, disagreements and mixed signals can always occur. What we need is a paradigm that includes not only the marvelous harmony within living organisms, but the conflicts that routinely break out. Chapter 8. Cellular Treason. What are these potentially fractious subunits, or building blocks, as they are sometimes called, of the body? And how can we effectively control them? One of the first cells a biology student is likely to encounter through a microscope is not a subunit of anything. It is a free living creature in its own right, a single-celled organism called an amoeba. Amoebae, which are easily found in pond water, swim through their environment searching for edible morsels, which they can then engulf with a pseudopod and ingest. I came across them in the laboratory of Maria Rudzinska, with whom I endured a few weeks-long tutorial along my winding path to a Ph.D. Her lab was the size of a closet, and she seemed annoyed at my presence, a situation that was not improved by my failure to see the relevance of her pet cells to my long-term interest in advancing human health. I was not interested in cells at all, those tiny lipid sacs containing proteins and nucleic acids. They were, from my thoroughly reductionist point of view, just distractions on the way to the real action, which took place at the chemical level that could only be accessed by bursting the cell membrane and grinding its contents into sludge. It even occurred to me that I had not been assigned to Rudzinska because she had anything to teach me, but simply because we shared the anomaly of being female in an overwhelmingly male research institute. Certainly, her amoebae were not the evolutionary progenitors of, or even models for, anything human. It took a couple of years before I began to appreciate events at the cellular level, and decades more, in fact, before I could see the connection between the lives of amoebae and those of the cells in our own bodies. One of the things that held me back was that amoebae are autonomous creatures. While the cells in our bodies obviously are not, they have functions to perform. But suppose that body cells, or some of them anyway, some of the time, are even a little bit autonomous. To the extent that the individual subunits of the body, the cells, are capable of acting on their own, there is always the possibility of mayhem. One can imagine fetal cells escaping from the fetus to pop up years later in some remote part of the mother's tissue, or an entire pregnancy being derailed when an embryo decides to implant somewhere other than in the uterus, in a fallopian tube, or even the abdominal cavity. Or cancer cells from other parts of the body could occasionally sneak past the blood-brain barrier to become a fifth column among the neurons that do our thinking for us. In fact, each of these things occurs. Women who have borne children often contain cells from the fetuses they have carried, making these women chimera, or mixtures of different individuals. Furthermore, in 1 or 2% of all pregnancies, the embryo arbitrarily attaches itself somewhere other than the uterus, resulting in a life-threatening situation for the mother. Even stranger, breast cancer cells have been caught disguising themselves as neurons to colonize the brain. Nor should we be surprised by these outbreaks of self-assertion on the part of cells and small groups of cells. Autoimmune diseases involve an apparently spontaneous attack by immune cells on other body cells. Cancer is a mad pursuit of Lebensraum originating in a single cell or a small group of cells. Fortunately, from the point of view of the organism as a whole, there are plenty of mechanisms to keep adventurous cells in place. Tissue cells are bound to each other by intercellular glue, as well as by junctions, some of them so tight as to be almost unbreakable. As an additional precaution, organs are often enclosed in membranes that may be difficult or impossible for a cell to breach. Then there is the steady hail of chemical signals that one cell receives from others, some of them sent from considerable distances. We can translate very few of these signals, and they appear to say things like, danger, or come here right away. And who knows, some of the messages may be propagandistic, urging cells to carry on stalwartly with their appointed tasks. Then there is the final sanction for a recalcitrant cell, death. Signals come in saying die, and in a process called apoptosis, the cell obligingly shuts down its metabolism, folds neatly into its membrane, and awaits disposal. But there are some cells that are required by their agreed-upon function in the body to be adventurous, inquisitive, and even aggressive. Leukocytes, for the most part, or the white blood cells that fight microbial diseases. Like red blood cells, many leukocytes originate in the bone marrow and are carried around passively by the bloodstream. Others, however, are capable of moving on their own, even through the dense and slippery spaces between cells in a tissue. With the exception of stem cells, there is probably no cell in the body more versatile than the macrophage, which originates, like so many other leukocytes, in the bone marrow. Immature macrophages, called monocytes, are released into the bloodstream, where they may become attracted to a stationary object, like a dead or injured cell, and settle down to devour it. As the macrophage eats, it grows and becomes activated. Filled with vacuoles containing digestive enzymes that allow it to eat still more. My PhD research eventually involved harvesting macrophages from mice and studying this transformation. Although its significance was unclear to me, I could see immediately that a mature macrophage resembles nothing so much as a free-living amoeba. The resemblance is so striking that it has tempted some scientists to speculate that there may be some kind of evolutionary connection between the two types of cells, although, of course, they come from totally unrelated lineages. Like a free-living amoeba, a macrophage can move around by extending a pseudopod and dragging itself along. It can dispose of dead or injured cells in a wound. It can attack and eat microbes that have found their way into the body. As the all-purpose handyman of the body, the macrophage has gotten very little respect from mainstream science. It's a blue-collar worker, and since it's responsible for removing cell corpses and other trash, it's been called the garbage collector of the body, and even, given its lethal capacities, a thug. The macrophage's MO as a killer is indeed rather brutal and thug-like. It engulfs its prey in its cell membrane and proceeds to digest it through the same process of phagocytosis that amoebae use, which is to say it turns its body into a terrifying mouth, like the vagina dentata or toothed vagina of folklore. Some killer cells of the immune system, more fastidiously, inject their prey with poisons and move on. Others extrude extracellular threads that entrap and kill microbes. But the macrophage actually eats its prey, and this may give it a measure of independence unknown to most other body cells, which are totally dependent on the bloodstream for their nutrients. Until recently, though, immunologists were far more interested in antibodies than in macrophages or any killer cells. Antibodies are the ingeniously bespoke protein molecules designed to bind to particular antigens, or patches of a microbe's surface, either disabling the microbe or marking it for destruction by macrophages. In the grand drama of antibody production, which was really the only drama in immunology once the molecular biologist seized center stage, macrophages were given only a minor supportive role. Their job was to present bits of foreign material, or antigens, to the presumably far cleverer white blood cells called lymphocytes that would manufacture the appropriate antibodies. As philosopher of science Emily Martin has pointed out, there is also a gender dimension to the derogation of macrophages, which have been described in the immunological literature as housekeepers and little drudges. But here I must pause to confess that I am simplifying to an extent that would annoy many cellular immunologists. The alternative would be to descend into the dizzying detail of technical debates over the classification of cells. Some sources, for example, insist that the central antigen-presenting cells are not macrophages, but a related cell type called dendritic cells, which also arise in the bone marrow and are also phagocytic. Others argue that dendritic cells do not exist as a cell type separate from macrophages, pointing out that both these putative cell types possess the same chemical markers on their surfaces and react the same way to chemical growth factors in their environment. More important, both types are capable of presenting antigens to lymphocytes and causing them to produce the appropriate antibodies, so that whether we call them macrophages, dendritic cells, or something more indecisive, they get the job done. This kind of taxonomic puzzle arises again and again in cellular immunology, where the mutability and mobility of individual cells constantly thwart rigid systems of classification. A macrophage, bursting with ingested material, in no way resembles a newly minted monocyte entering the bloodstream for the very first time. The simplest system of classification is between the good guys and the bad guys, the latter being microbes and other threats to the body. Without any question, macrophages were the good guys, gobbling up microbes and often going on to help generate the production of antibodies that would coat any identical microbial invaders to make them even more appetizing to macrophages. How creative a role macrophages play in defense of the body, whether they are simply the cleanup crew or are more intimately involved in antibody production, is still not entirely clear. But to me, as a lowly graduate student, they were heroes, always rushing out fearlessly to defend the body against microbes or other threats. They might be slow-witted compared to lymphocytes that produce antibodies, but they were in the vanguard of bodily defense. Or so I thought until around the turn of the millennium, when some disturbing findings surfaced in the biomedical literature. Macrophages had been known since the 19th century to gather at tumor sites, leading Virchow and others to speculate that cancer is caused by inflammation, meaning a gathering of leukocytes at some site of injury or infection. Or, more optimistically, one might imagine that the macrophages were massing for an assault on the tumor. Instead, it turned out that they spent their time in the neighborhood of tumors encouraging the cancer cells to continue on their reproductive rampage. They are cheerleaders on the side of death. Francis Balkwill, one of the cell biologists who contributed to the recognition of treasonous macrophage behavior, described her colleagues in the field as being horrified. By and large, medical science continues to present a happy face to the public. Self-help books and websites go right on advising cancer patients to boost their immune systems in order to combat the disease. Patients should eat right and cultivate a supposedly immune-boosting positive attitude. Better yet, they are urged to visualize the successful destruction of cancer cells by the body's immune cells, following guidelines such as, cancer cells are weak and confused, and should be imagined as something that can fall apart like ground hamburger. There is an army of different kinds of white blood cells that can overwhelm the cancer cells. White blood cells are aggressive and want to seek out and attack the cancer cells. Philosophically, it is not easy to imagine one's own immune cells becoming accomplices in the deadly project of cancer, and denial has lingered on even in far more reputable venues than the self-help literature. In 2012, the distinguished physician and science writer Jerome Groopman wrote an entire article in The New Yorker on scientific attempts to enlist the immune system in fighting cancer, without once mentioning that certain immune cells, macrophages, have a tendency to go over to the other side. The omission is made all the stranger by the fact that Groopman introduces his essay with a story about a young woman in 1890 whose hand injury led to a long and painful inflammation, which was followed by a fatal metastatic sarcoma. In the article, he assures us, without explanation, that the sarcoma was unrelated to her initial injury. By 2012, though, there had already been reports about the role of macrophages in injury-induced sarcomas. Similarly, a 2016 New York Times article on harnessing the immune system to fight cancer makes no mention of macrophage treason. The evidence for macrophage collusion with cancer keeps piling up. Macrophages supply cancer cells with chemical growth factors and help build the new blood vessels required by a growing tumor. So intimately are they involved with the deadly progress of cancer that they can account for up to 50% of a tumor's mass. Macrophages also appear to be necessary if the cancer is to progress to its deadliest phase, metastasis, and if a cancerous mouse is treated to eliminate all its macrophages, the tumor stops metastasizing. Just in the last decade, scientists have begun to understand the perverse interaction that can lead macrophages and tumor cells to pool their resources and overwhelm the organism. The first part of the story can be expressed almost entirely in terms of chemistry. Any reasonably genteel meeting of two cells begins with an exchange of chemical messages, more or less like an exchange of business cards between two professionals. Only in the cellular case, the transaction can quickly get out of hand. As a 2014 article on breast cancer in the journal Cancer Cell suggests, the macrophages release a growth factor that encourages the cancer cells to elongate themselves into a mobile, invasive form poised for metastasis. These elongated cancer cells, in turn, release a chemical that further activates the macrophages, leading to the release of more growth factor, and so on. A positive feedback loop is established. Or to put it more colorfully, the macrophages and cancer cells seem to excite one another to the point where the cancer cells are pumped up and ready to set out from the breast in search of fresh territory to conquer. In the lungs, for example, or the liver or brain. But describing the cellular interactions strictly in terms of the exchange of chemical messages is like trying to portray a human courtship as little more than an interaction of pheromones. For a more intimate view of what goes on between cells in the living body, we need to turn to the results of ingenious new techniques of microscopy capable of visualizing individual cells in the opaque environment of an active tumor. A kind of intravital microscopy, developed at John Condylis's lab at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, reveals that macrophages from within the tumor pair off with cancer cells to enter a blood vessel that would otherwise be impenetrable to the cancer cells. The macrophage has the chops, so to speak, to pry apart two adjacent blood vessel cells and make a hole through which the cancer cell can escape to colonize other parts of the body. And the cancer cells are desperate to escape, since their own reproductive success creates a suffocatingly crowded environment within the tumor, dangerously short of oxygen. So it doesn't take just one rogue cell to create a metastatic cancer. It takes two, a cancer cell plus a normal, healthy, and all-too-helpful macrophage. A science writer has to guard against over-dramatizing and anthropomorphizing the events she is reporting on, but here the scientists involved have already done that for me. In 2015, two younger members of the Condylis lab put together a short film showing the macrophage-tumor-cell interactions that lead to breast cancer metastasis, both in animation and live footage of the microscopic events. The film begins with one of the narrators, a graduate student, wondering aloud in an ominous tone what genre of movie it belongs to. Horror, action, or war? In his blog, the director of the National Institutes of Health likens the film to Mission Impossible and writes almost breathlessly, "Without giving too much of the plot away, let me just say that it involves cancer cells escaping from a breast tumor and spreading, or metastasizing, to other parts of the body. Along the way, those dastardly cancer cells take advantage of collagen fibers to make a tightrope getaway and recruit key immune cells called macrophages to serve as double agents to aid and abet their diabolical spread." Breast cancer is not the only form of cancer that depends on macrophages for access to blood vessels and hence metastasis to new sites in the body. So far, there is evidence that macrophages assist in the metastasis of lung, bone, gastric, and other cancers. And the macrophages' fiendish role in the growth of cancer does not end after they have escorted tumor cells into the bloodstream. Once at the remote site where the tumor cells have decided to settle, macrophages get to work on the job of angiogenesis, building new blood vessels to nourish the tumor. Whether the same macrophages that guide cancer cells into the bloodstream go on to do the work of angiogenesis is not known, at least as far as I can tell. Their complicity in cancer should be enough to disqualify macrophages as good guys, but that is not the only form of mischief that macrophages get into. Many pathological or at least annoying conditions, from acne to arthritis, arise from inflammation. And inflammation, which involves a variety of leukocytes, is spearheaded by macrophages. Acne, for example, is widely attributed to a bacterial infection, including by the manufacturers of a bactericidal cleanser called Physohex, who advertised that their product will fight the bacteria, dirt, and oil that bring on acne and pimples, although it is now well known that these ugly eruptions can occur in the absence of the bacterial suspects. At a later phase in the human life cycle, we find macrophages involved in arthritis and diabetes, as well as chewing away at living bones to produce osteoporosis. The blood vessels leading to the heart might be one of the last places you would expect to find errant immune cells, and for years the narrowing of these vessels, which can lead to heart attacks and strokes, was understood to be a result of fatty deposits along the arterial walls. Anyone seeking heart health was exhorted to eliminate saturated fat and cholesterol from their diet, if not all red meats and all forms of fat. Atherosclerosis, narrowing of the cardiac arteries, was all about fats and grease, according to Peter Libby, a cardiologist and professor at Harvard Medical School. Most physicians saw atherosclerosis as a straight plumbing problem. Then came the discovery that the bad cholesterol in these arteries can trigger an inflammation that sets off strokes and heart attacks. Another case, according to Libby, of our body's defenses turned against ourselves. Inflammation means an accumulation of macrophages, which a 2015 article asserts play important roles in all stages of atherosclerosis. At this point, the emphasis on inflammation as a cause, if not the cause, of human ailments has achieved the dimensions of a fad. In a 2015 New Yorker article by Groupman, which is significant, among other things, for granting macrophages a status higher than janitors,